It's Mailbag 5, Weekend at Mailbags. Would Tony Romo still be a top 10 quarterback had he not retired? Why don't we see quick 250-pound offensive linemen? And, of course, who has the NFL's worst uniforms? We've got it all in the finale of the Mailbag series of the MMQB 10 Things podcast.
The MMQB presents the MMQB 10 Things podcast, powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your hosts, Andy Benoit and Gary Gramling.
Hello and welcome to the MMQB 10 Things podcast. I'm Gary Gramling. He is Andy Benoit. And we have reached the final segment of the Mailbag series, the final show, Mailbag 5, Weekend at Mailbags. Here's the thing, real quick, before I let you chime in, Andy. We're not going to get to literally all the questions we said we would get to. We're just not. There were too many. What we are going to do is we are going to fold some questions into next show, which will be the big season preview extravaganza. So if you had a question specific to a team and the upcoming season, we are going to include that when we do the season preview next show. So for instance, Mitch, who wrote in about Tyrod Taylor and our opinions on Tyrod Taylor, we will talk about Tyrod Taylor and we will address your questions specifically on the preview show. The mailbag, in a way, will always be a part of us. But this is going to be it for the pure mailbag shows, at least for now. Mailbag 5, Weekend at Mailbags. How you feeling, Andy?
I'm feeling good. And so we will get to every question. They're just not all going to be in the 5 mailbag shows.
We will. I just want to say up top, because obviously, you know, this is the last mailbag show. If you don't hear your question, there's still one more sort of mailbag show coming up. It's just not going to be branded a mailbag show because, frankly, I ran out of sequel titles that we could use. So
it's too bad you don't work for the Fast and Furious franchise.
Yes, I could never keep up.
We could have ended that garbage. We could have ended that garbage years ago. Although they're just adding numbers, aren't they? Don't they just add numbers to the end of it? I don't even watch the Fast and Furious.
I don't know. It was
franchise.
Always like faster and furiouser, and the fastest and the furiest and the I don't know. I think it was
okay.
A bunch of those.
Yeah.
I just figured it would always lead to the... I always thought I'd die that way. I thought someone imitating the Fast and the Furious on, like, I-95 out here is... And they'd crash into me, and that's how
yep.
I'll die. That's my prediction, at least.
Well, there's still plenty of time.
All right. Good. Let's go into the mailbag. First question. This is coming from Josh from the UK. I'm gonna boil down your question a little bit, Josh. He is asking, for an offensive scheme... Does the scheme or does the defensive talent play a bigger part in determining where offensive lines direct their double teams? And I'll ask you that in two parts, Andy. Well, running game and then pass protection. I imagine for pass protection, you are deciding who are going to double team based on who the most dangerous guy is.
Typically, yeah. I mean, the answer is that's a good question. It varies. The running game, I don't think you get that. That's just more of the structure of the geometry of it. Running game's pretty cookie cutter play to play. There's not as much creativity in terms of blocking assignments and who we're going to help and get matchups on. You can certainly be creative in your designs, and you can avoid trying, like, you don't want a tight end to have to block a defensive end one-on-one, so you can tweak things, but that's it's a lot more limited versus pass protection, where you can slide the O-line or add a chip block or offset a running back to the side of a dominant pass rusher. You can have a little bit more creativity to respond to guys you want to respond to on the defensive side.
Yeah.
Keep in mind, though, a lot of times protection is based off of the routes. And so if you've got the ball on one hash or the other, which is almost always the case on every snap, then the strength of the field factors into what the protection is, the strength of where your receivers are. If you've got three receivers to one side, that's going to make your protection different than if you have one receiver to the other side. All these variables come into play, and it's a great idea of where does it begin and end, chicken and egg. Are we responding to pass rushers first? Are we trying to feature our receivers first? Who's in charge of the matchups there? Is the defense dictating or is the offense dictating? And that's where it gets into personnel. And are you facing a solid pass rusher like Kerry Hyder, who I know is out for the season, unfortunately,
mm-hmm.
or are you facing Von Miller? And that changes the discussion as well. So it's really a case-by-case basis. And often within the game, there's 30 different examples of how it goes.
It's a good nuanced answer, Andy. Next question here. This is Ben from Germany. I would like to know what you consider the three most important stats for each position. I don't know if we have each position, but let me say this, Andy. If you're looking at a box score of a game you didn't see, what are you looking for? What three stats would you look for first? Like I personally would look for I think yards per attempt is a good really broad way of looking at a quarterback's performance.
I agree. That's what I would look for defensively. And you don't see these stats in the box score, unfortunately, but passer rating against often is the best indicator of how a defense played overall. And that doesn't factor in sacks, but it can kind of factor in pressure, because if your pressure is getting home, you're forcing incompletions and hurried throws, and that's going to factor into the passer rating. I would say that one. And then the other one that I usually look for, just if I'm trying to figure out what was a game like, is total yards, but then the rushing yards, and then how long was the longest run? Because if they ran 20 times for 100 yards, but they had a run of 80 yards, that kind of tells you the flow of the game, versus if they had a run that was the longest of 8 yards and the other 19 gained 92 yards. I mean, that tells you a different flow of the game. So those are the things I look for, but we all know I'm not going to look super closely at stats. I do check that when I start the film to get an idea of what the game's flow is going to be like.
All right. Next question. This is coming Oliver from Singapore. I started following the NFL in 1991 as a youngster in the UK. Unfortunately, that made me a Washington fan, and since the Dan Snyder era, teamless. With kids of my own now, I want to bring them up following a team that does things right as an organization and isn't a tire fire from year to year on the field, too. I'm curious to know which team Mr.s. Grambling and Benoit would recommend. Andy, I know you're not a big fan of these questions, but, I mean, honestly, if a kid came up to you and said, Mr. Benoit, I do not know, and Oliver, by the way, was nice enough to call us Mr.s. Grambling and Benoit. Mr. Benoit, I like football. I don't know who to root for. Who should I root for? What would you say?
If we're talking like a little kid, I'd tell him, expose the kid to football. Just let him watch football when you're watching, and he'll find his own favorite team. It'll show itself.
Well, I'll say Packers then.
Okay. All right. Very good.
Because my wife roots for the Packers because she likes the whole ownership thing there, and that has treated her well over her 15 or so years of football fandom. So. Yeah, I don't know.
The kid's going to decide based on the quarterback, the flashiest non-quarterback, and the uniforms. Those will be the three deciding factors for who the kid picks.
Yeah. Colts? I feel like the Colts will turn a corner soon, and you can sort of get on the bandwagon early. That's not a bad one. That's my advice.
Yeah, no, I figure if I respond, this will never end. So I'm Colts and Packers are great with me.
All right, next question is Brendan from Toronto. Okay, so this is a question about character concerns and red flags. Brendan says, specifically, it's a pet peeve of mine that players like Josh Rosen are painted with the same brush as Greg Hardy or Johnny Manziel or Ezekiel Elliott, et cetera, with scouts describing them as a mess off the field or something along those lines. I understand it's easier for quick-hitting scout analysis to just say character's an issue, but do coaches not differentiate between these types of players, i.e. someone who is very smart but potentially immature and prone to speaking his mind, versus someone who has had real trouble with the law? For me, this is a big difference, putting a headband calling out to America's president or putting a hot tub in your dorm room and getting charged for domestic violence, but those are one and the same for button-up NFL coaches. Is it that way? Sort of butchered the end of that question. Sorry, Brendan. But in short, I'll say this, and I've been the editor of, I'd say, 90% of our draft coverage over the last 3 years. There is. Coaches do look at it differently. I mean, that's part of the reconnaissance work they do on all of these guys going into the draft, and you know, I guess what happens is when you report these things, and I'll give a for instance here, but not specify the player. There was a player who we heard from someone who we trust and is reliable. This is when Emily Kaplan was writing her draft coverage, that he had disappeared for about 3 weeks after the season, and his coaches all figured he was on another bender. because that's what he does. He goes out and just drinks and smokes a lot, and that's how he does things. You know, we couldn't corroborate that. It was just the suspicions of a coach, but you know, you get an idea of what they think of that guy, and whether you know they think he's a young guy who is a little bit different, or if he is a bad guy. And not that guys keep around, you know, college coaches don't keep around guys who are bad guys, but you know, there are different degrees. Is the guy immature, or is he an awful person? And you can get a sense, but you can't always spell everything out when you're doing your reporting. Kind of like, you know, I'm doing right now. I'm not really spelling out
right
this whole thing that well.
What coaches care about is, they all care about these guys off the field the same way you care about your neighbors or your cousins or whoever, people you know. But when it comes to the football decisions, it's how much does it impact what happens on the field. And so if this guy who goes on a bender, if he's doing it for 3 weeks after the season, that concerns the coaches, but not the same way it would if it were the 3 weeks right before the season. And it's true with the NFL guys as well. It's first of all, can you play? So how good are you on the field? And then is your behavior, if you're like a locker room cancer, for example, that disrupts a lot of people, including yourself on the field, versus if you do something even that's a felony off the field, but it's kind of in a vacuum, your own thing. Locker room cancer is going to be worse in the eyes of people. That's why in the NFL, that's why Greg Hardy's out of the league. It's not because of what he did to that lady off the field in what year, 2014, something like that. It was the way he conducted himself in Dallas in 2015 or whenever he was there, showing up late to meetings, saying stupid garbage in the media, making an ass of himself, revealing himself to be an ass, really. So that's what does it. And how good are you on the field, and does the behavior impact you and others on the field?
There's also a calculation, and a lot of this comes from ownership or some other people in the front office. There's a calculation with, you know, a guy like Greg Hardy. I mean, Greg Hardy basically had interest from one team after the Panthers dropped him. 31 teams, despite his talent, passed on him because of the, in short, the PR hit he would bring. So, I mean, that stuff factors in. Joe Mixon would have been a top 15 pick, maybe even top 10, top 5, if he did not have the background that he had. So, teams calculate it.
But it's what's different, though, is those teams didn't have those guys in the first place. So they're adding to it, which is a different PR thing. If the Cowboys were to add Ezekiel Elliott now and he'd never been on the team before, their whole interpretation of his situation, we don't know what happened there, but from the PR standpoint, his situation, that would be very different versus he's already on the team, he's in our culture, he's one of us now. And Gary, often with these guys, and I don't know anything about Joe Mixon, but Hardy, for example, remember he fell in the draft because there were big concerns about him outside of football before, and teams thought he was emotionally and mentally unstable, and they mm-hmm. took him off their board. So, and that's not an unusual circumstance. These guys that have these problems, especially multiple problems away from football, they often have problems that aren't technically illegal either, and they're never going to get arrested for, but that are still very disruptive to their lives and their coworkers' lives. So it's rare that a guy has an isolated incident, and it happens, but it's rare. So that also factors in. All the things we don't know about, we don't know all the other stuff Greg Hardy's done that's concerned teams, but there's absolutely a list of it, and teams have to digest that list differently.
Can I tackle one more part of this here, Andy? And it's the mm-hmm. Josh Rosen thing. Have you followed the Josh Rosen stuff? Do you
vaguely,
even know who Josh Rosen is, Andy?
Yeah. He's UCLA quarterback. Yeah.
So, look, Josh Rosen is he's a bit of a he's a strong individual. He's a beat of a different drummer type of guy, and I think you'll hear. You know, assuming he comes out in the draft this year, and certainly he's a high first round talent, this is going to be a discussion that goes around a lot, you know, from January to April next year. And look, guys who are different, and he's different in it, not in the same way that Greg Hardy was different, but you know, guys who are, you know, a little bolder, a little harder to handle, maybe for a coaching staff. I mean, those are concerns for a team as well.
no question about it, and especially at the quarterback position. Some teams might like it and say, oh, yeah, we want that kind of leadership from that position. Others might be really turned off by it. 32 teams have 32 different decision makers, and a lot of those teams have multiple decision makers. So there's a lot of personal preferences that factor into all this stuff, too.
Yeah. We'll be hearing plenty about Josh Rosen over the next 8 months or so here. Next question. This is Dave G. from Hillsborough, New Jersey. How would you rate the positions on both sides of the ball in terms of importance to a team's success? For instance, for two equally skilled individuals, is a quarterback four times as valuable as a wide receiver? So let's say a slightly above average quarterback versus a slightly above average wide receiver. Andy, ice cold, hard math. How much more valuable is the quarterback than the wide receiver?
7.2 times, I guess. Nobody thinks about it like that. But quarterback's the most important position because that's the one that sculpts the identity of people around you. A quarterback can change a wide receiver's identity. A wide receiver can't necessarily change what your quarterback is. So, and that's true with offensive line as well. Quarterback can make your offensive line look better than it is and play better than it is. We're not saying anything groundbreaking by saying it all starts with the quarterback. And on defense, that's where it gets a little more nuanced, is what kind of scheme do we run and who do we want to build around? Do we build around our secondary or do we build around our front four?
Well, yeah, and like we've said, you know, a team like the Carolina Panthers, not a whole lot of, not a whole lot of stock in cornerbacks considering the scheme they run, whereas, a lot of teams that go more man-heavy and maybe don't have the same kind of a front four, they put a bigger emphasis on their on their cornerback play. But let's see. Next question here is coming from Chazberg. This is from a designer and uniform obsessive. So this will be part two of the uniform conversation. Which is each of your favorite current NFL uniforms? We answered that two shows ago, I should say. I think we both agreed Packers and Steelers were the best, maybe a tie.
Yeah, the stuff with the yellow in it, because it contrasts so well with other teams' uniforms.
Chazberg says his favorite is the Bears, and his least favorite is the Buccaneers and their "oh no, I'm late for work" numbers. I would agree. I think the Bucs are definitively the worst. I think there's no doubt about that.
Jacksonville, you got to factor in Jacksonville too.
Jacksonville's helmet just destroys everything.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't even tell if I like the uniform or not because I can't get past the helmet.
And, I like the Bears
Titans,
too.
I think the Titans are secretly bad. I hate that font that they use.
They're changing them next year. They're changing
the
Titans uniforms. Apparently, they're going to do it drastically. We hear that all the time. No one really drastically changes their uniforms, though. It hasn't happened since, Denver after and before the 97-98 season. I think it's the 97 season. Remember, they went to the blue, and they've always been the Orange Crush.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. You might be
right. Who else is drastically? There's obviously a lot of teams change it subtly, and they might change it a few times subtly, so it evolves. I like the Bears, too, though. I agree with the question or the guy's opinion because the Bears, the blue is very different depending on the light. Sometimes it looks black. Other times it looks cobalt. It just varies. I like the Bears. I like their white uniforms too.
Can I just say one more I hate? And mostly I'm just really disappointed in this team for the uniforms they have, is the Patriots. I hate the Patriots uniforms.
Really?
The old Pat Patriot ones were so much better. And it's in part because, obviously they're always on and they're always in the playoffs and deep in the playoffs and the Super Bowl, so you see them all the time. Their uniforms look like someone in 1998 was trying to predict what people would like in uniforms in 2014, and that's how they came up with that. And I dislike it a lot.
So, see, I like because they have the red face mask with the silver helmet and then a blue jersey. I like when the face mask contrasts with the rest of the uniform. It's a nice touch.
And I agree. I hate the uniform itself, though. Like the jersey itself.
I don't understand. Their white uniforms have on the blue uniforms, they wear a solid blue sock. On the white uniforms, they wear a white sock with blue stripes at the top, which is pretty different. Do you remember who was the receiver they drafted in the second round about 8 years ago from Florida? Was it Chad Jackson? Was that his name?
Yes.
So there was a game once where Chad Jackson, it might be his only game, where he caught a pass and broke away and ran for a touchdown. And the defender trying to tackle him swiped at his legs and missed. But in the process, he pulled down Chad Jackson's sock. And Jackson was in the white jersey that day. And beneath his striped sock, his white and blue striped sock, he had a solid red sock underneath it. And as soon as I saw it, I thought, why don't they wear those red socks all the time? Because they look tremendous with the white uniforms. And I wish New England would add a red sock and do a little more red in their road jerseys. That's my only complaint about the uniform. Otherwise, I like it a lot. And I think you're totally, totally off base.
Oh, those things are gross. No. No good. We'll never
agree
on
that.
I'm so upset I might shut down the show right now. But we won't. We'll move on because we still have 1,000 other questions to get to. This is Timothy Riggins. The consensus among statisticians and game theory experts who have analyzed fourth down decision-making is that teams should go for it on fourth down a ton more. Would you agree with this assessment? And if so, why do you think this is the case? I'm especially curious about Andy's extremely analytical but not statistical view. So what do you think about it, Andy? Because we've heard that a lot over the years. Statistically, fourth down, teams should be going for it on fourth down much more often than they do.
Well, we need to know how they're finding those stats, because if they're looking at it from only the offensive side, that's very different. They're saying, well, yeah, you get it 52% of the time, so that's, in the long run, you're better off doing it. That's a limited stat, because what you have to keep in mind, if you go for it on fourth down and miss, you swing the field position by about 45 yards against you. And those 45 yards usually mean at least 3 points and can mean up to 6 or 7 points. Are they factoring that in the misses? Because when you miss, the offense, your opposing offense, has a much easier time scoring against you. And that's why coaches don't do it. And I don't know, if these are rocket scientists doing these formulas, and sometimes they are, hopefully they're thinking about that. I bet fans don't think about that a whole lot. It's not just, are you getting the first down or not as an offense? It's what position are you leaving your defense in, and what are the consequences of that position and the flow of the game? If you give up a touchdown on the next series because the opposing team only had 25 or 30 yards to go instead of 75 yards, that's going to impact everything else in the game, including your own offense next time you take the field.
Yes. I think another big part of it is what play can you dial up in that situation? I mean, do you have something that you are confident can work there? Just saying, okay, it's fourth and five, let's go, let's run a play. Well, do you have something? Do you have something in your pocket that you've sort of set up over the course of a game? My other thing with this, and I do agree that teams should go for it on a fourth down more, but when you do that, if you're not Bill Belichick, and we all remember Belichick did it in Indianapolis, that one Sunday night game, that was probably, 7 or 8 years ago now.
Yeah.
You can do – Bill Belichick can be bold and do things that are sort of counter to what people have done traditionally and not face any consequence for it. But a lot of coaches, you do that, and now you're the guy who blew it on fourth down, and now the fan base wants you out because you've only been there for 2 years, and your team was 9-7 last year, and you're going to be 7-9 this year, and that's it. And you basically just sunk your career with making a move that was a little more aggressive, whereas if you just punted or took the field goal or whatever it would be, no one would have noticed. That's why coaches hate the two-point conversion stuff. It's just another decision they have to make.
And I think the first part of what you said, there's the part to really grab onto. It's, do you have a play that you like? Coaches draw up their play sheets in accordance with how often a situation occurs. So they have a bunch of first and 10 plays on their sheet. They have a decent number of third down and 2 yards to 6 yards to go type of plays, or whatever, whatever their factors are. Usually it's third down and six or less, third down and six or more. There aren't a lot of fourth and one situations in a game. So teams, you can't put everything into your playbook. You don't have time during the week to do that. You have to be choosy. Teams usually only have 2 or 3 fourth down and one, and it's going to be their third down and one plays as well. They might have 2 or 3 of those, maybe 5 or 6. And so there's not a lot to choose from. So you have to have one you really do like, you're right, against the opponent. You have to have seen something from the opponent on film that week and then see it within the course of the game and make your decision there. You're exactly right about – it's not like people when they're playing Madden and they just all of a sudden feel a wave of aggression and let's go for it and be the, you know, be courageous. That's not how – it works that way sometimes. Often it doesn't work when it goes that way. But that's not usually how the decisions are made in the NFL.
Yeah. Next question. This is Andrew from London. Which team is best set up to win over the next 5 to 7 years, i.e. become the next dynasty? Not looking for a simple analysis. Saying team with the best QB, that's too easy. Sometimes that masks a poor team. See the Colts and Peyton Manning. I'm an Eagles fan, so hoping for at least an honorable mention. Eagles are in good shape, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you're a big Wentz guy, Andy.
He doesn't want us talking about his quarterback, but his example is it defeats the question a little bit because it does come down to the quarterback.
Yes.
Maybe Peyton Manning did mask a bad team. Who cares? They weren't a bad team in the end. They won their division every year. They were in Super Bowl contention many years. They won a Super Bowl in 2006. I think Philly is in a good spot because Wentz is the guy I like. I think the other team is Dallas because of that offensive line that gives mm-hmm. them a clear – any team that has a long-term identity in place. And for most teams, that means your quarterback, and we're going to build around our quarterback. In Dallas, yeah. It's an unusual situation. They have the long-term offensive line in place. But that's what it is. You change your roster so much over the next 7 years – you probably have 5 to 7 guys on your current roster now who will be here 7 years from now. So it's who are those 5 to 7 guys? That's it. Who are those guys? And what do they tell us about the rest of us?
Yeah. I mean, you throw out the Colts if they get it together. You throw out the Raiders. You throw out the Seahawks probably. Maybe the Bucks. Maybe the
Titans.
By
throw out, you mean throw in. You put them in the discussion. Yeah.
Well, I throw out to the discussion. Throw out into the world.
Okay.
And then they land in this conversation.
Of course.
Let's see. Next question here. This is Peter Pandabomb. Pretty good name.
What's the
most innovative thing you guys have seen happen in the game recently? And separately, who do you guys think is the most innovative coach or front office member in the league? Boy, most innovative thing. I would throw Daryl Bevel out there and what he's done with the Seattle offense, and the fact that they have been, they've been really diverse, and I feel like on one hand they need to settle on an identity at some point, but on the other hand, the fact that they've been able to do so many different things and do them well with what's a not very good offensive line and Russell Wilson, who's an exceedingly talented, but let's be honest, non-traditional quarterback. That's a vague answer, but I throw that out there.
I think for in the passing game, it's the teams that have come up with route combinations that beat single high coverage. Atlanta's done a tremendous job of that mm-hmm. with Kyle Shanahan, and now we'll see if San Francisco does. But he had some designs last year. I remember the Seahawks game is the great illustration. But there were other plays where he designed cover three beaters with pre-snap motion and shifting involving those tight ends and running backs. And the design of the play, it was going to work every time. It literally could not be defended by cover three. And that's true of all plays. You draw up plays that can't be defended by the coverage. But a lot of times it's plays that really put the coverage in a bind, out-leverage a coverage, make it difficult. These were plays that literally could not be defended. The coverage had no way to possibly account for it. Tevin Coleman had a touchdown on a wheel type of route out of a shotgun offset shotgun position. I forget who it was against, but it was about a 15-yard touchdown last year that had a lot of people in the NFL talking about it because it was they had three receivers to one side. That beat the cover three, and then they ran Coleman to that same side, and there was the fourth receiver, and there was no defender that could – there was nobody around to take him. That kind of stuff is where innovation comes from. That not only evolves your offense, it evolves the defenses too because now you can't play cover three against that. So we have to think of something else, or we have to change our cover three. And eventually it becomes a whole different type of coverage. That's the evolution of the game. The other thing is teams that have these mobile quarterbacks, people say, well, read option. There's a lot more going on than just the read option. There are what they're doing now are building multiple running plays within the same one. So you can hand off to the running back, and he might have a power concept. There's a receiver as an end around or a pitch option, and then there's the quarterback on a sweep option. And there's basically three running plays built into one that you have to choose from. And what the teams also do is if the quarterback doesn't hand it off to the running back, the play is designed in a way where that running back then becomes the lead blocker. So the running back's essentially the running back and the fullback, depending on how the play works out. That is really innovative. That's a lot to defend. That makes defenses play slower, and I think it's one reason that these mobile quarterbacks should not be dismissed from the conversation. Even though I'm a big pocket passing guy, we're talking about run game design, and Carolina has the best opportunity to do this than anyone, and they have done it. That's where the game has really evolved, is all the variables that go into running plays on some of these mobile quarterback teams.
There you go. Next question. This is Cuse in LA, who loves when Jeff Irwin throws off our rankings, but publicly scolds me for throwing my parents under the bus for putting 6-year-old self as a lifeguard for my 3-year-old brother at the pool.
When you shared that they did that they had you lifeguard your brother when you were 6 and the brother was 3.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not a good idea. I couldn't swim.
You just scolded them again right there for everyone to hear. But you have like 6 brothers or something, don't you? They had you grew up in a family. There were brothers to spare. They could be a little more liberal with their kids.
Yeah,
they just had the numbers.
They had 4 of us. So, you got a little leeway there with what goes on. You break a couple, you got more.
Yep.
Let's see. The question is, outside of injury, where would Tony Romo have ranked on the QB list? Did a top 10 QB walk away? Obviously, it's tough to say because he played, one series last year in the end, although he looked really good during that one series.
I'd almost have to say we need to disqualify the question. It's not a bad question, but it's been so long since Romo's played meaningful snaps that I don't know how I would have ranked him I have no idea.
If we had to rank him, if he was still playing right now and we had to rank him, I said this during our quarterback show. I feel like there's 21 or 22 teams who, as much as we talk about the quarterback crisis and there's not enough quarterbacks, there's 21 or 22 teams who are probably satisfied with the quarterback situation right now. They have either a guy entrenched or they have a young guy who they have reason to feel good about. So I think you have to put Romo in that 15 to 20 range, I guess.
Well, it gets into how are we ranking. Are we ranking the players in a vacuum? This is the same problem we have with all these ranking things. Is it the player in a vacuum, or is it the player within the context of his team and the scheme and everything he does there? Those are two different things. And Romo in a vacuum, that's hard. Then the third factor is how do we treat injuries? Do we hold it against a guy and try to play doctor, or do we just pretend everybody's healthy because nobody's healthy? And I don't know the answer to that, but that Romo's the hardest guy to answer on all of this because he falls into all of these discussions. He's not healthy, and he in a vacuum was a different player than what he meant to the Cowboys because he'd become a field general, and he was very valuable to Dallas in their scheme as a guy that could run the scheme up at the line of scrimmage. But then, Gary, Dak Prescott, you could say, he's valuable to Dallas' scheme because he's mobile, and when they do your bootlegs and your play-action rollouts, Prescott can impact the backside defenders, which helps Ezekiel Elliott on the front side running game. And that's a ton of what they do in Dallas. You didn't get that with Romo. You do get it with Prescott. How do we grade that? Are we giving Prescott points for that because the defense fears what he might do on a backside run? Or do we say, he's handing the ball off. That doesn't have a lot to do with anything. We're not going to critique the quarterback on that. And there's no right or wrong answer to any of this, which is why rankings always need to be taken with many grains of salt.
All right. Next question. This is coming from Yves from London. You guys talk about formations and motion and how they can force a defense to reveal whether it's man or zone coverage. Is this something that offenses do all the time on planned passing plays? And if they do not, then why not? So, basically, we've talked about, we talked a lot last year about The Falcons putting Patrick DeMarco, their fullback, out wide to see if he'd be covered by a linebacker or by a cornerback, and that would tell them what the opponent's coverage is. Do teams do that? Is that now something teams do literally all the time to try and get the defense to tip the hand, Andy?
Interestingly, the good ones do. New England does it probably 90% of the snaps. And it's not just motion. You can start with the guy out wide, too. Patrick DeMarco does not have to motion out wide. He can just go line up out wide, and you still get the same information. So I don't know why teams that's a great question to ask a coach is why. And I always ask coaches questions like this. They sound ridiculous, but that's how you get right to the bottom of something. Is why don't you do that on every snap? Why wouldn't you motion or invert your formations on every snap? And they'll have their reasons. A lot of it is, well, we have guys that can play outside but not inside, and if our best receiver can play outside, then we're not going to line them up inside, even though if we might get a more of a coverage indicator that way. I mean, it comes down to your personnel and how you can play with them. So the teams that have the more versatile personnel and the better personnel, they can do this more than the other clubs. But you're New England and Atlanta, those were the teams that did it the most often last season from my memory.
Yeah. Andy, this next question is very specific. I do not have an answer for it. I don't know if you will either, but I'll ask you because it was asked of us. This is David Shamritsky. During the offseason, players obviously do both football and non-football specific workouts. What approximate percentage are specifically assigned by coaches and trainers and then monitored by team personnel? So basically, how much of what a guy does during the offseason, how much is that coming down from what the team is giving them and the coaching staff or the front office is giving them?
Depends who it is. And the it just depends. It's the organization, it's the player who has what. I remember the Detroit Lions, Peter King reported this back in the Matt Millen era, reportedly didn't have an off-season training program for guys. And that just baffled Peter, and I'm sure it baffled a lot of people. If it was true, and Peter gets that stuff right, that was baffling to a lot of people in the NFL. Some teams are very involved with that kind of thing, but it just depends. I mean, guys, we hear all the time, guys that don't go to the team activities, they do stuff with their own trainer. That's their prerogative. It varies from guy to guy and team to team.
Okay. All right, Andy, hang on 1 second. Our friends from Barbasol, they're back again helping us out here. The biggest thing to happen to Barbasol since shaving cream is also the only thing to happen to Barbasol since shaving cream. Introducing new Barbasol razors, the brand America trusts for a close, comfortable shave, now has premium disposable razors. Barbasol's close shave technology on every razor means you get an advanced pivoting head and ultra-thin open-flow blades. The Ultra 6 Plus razor also features a seventh blade specifically designed to refine and style tricky areas like under the nose, sideburns, and beard. Visit Barbasol.com and get a $2 savings coupon and see for yourself why Barbasol razors are the number one new disposable razors out there. You're looking good, America. You're shaving with Barbasol. All right, back to the mailbag. And quite foolishly, I have lost the name of the gentleman or woman who sent this question in, so I apologize for that, but I will read the question nonetheless. Andy, how do you scout/watch defensive line play? Can sacks and tackles for loss be misleading in the same way that interceptions are for defensive backs?
Yeah, absolutely, because a lot of times they're created by someone else, and player A, a defensive tackle, gets penetration and forces the running back to bounce it outside before the blocks are ready for that, and so player B, a defensive end, gets the tackle for loss. It's absolutely a group effort a lot of the time. And so statistics are very misleading in that regard. They can be.
Do you have any tips for what you look for on defensive line when you're watching film?
So many teams play one gap schemes now, even the 3-4 teams. That penetration for most linemen, that's the tell, is that because that's what they're responsible for doing. So you look at that. I like it when guys. You have to know the player and what are his strengths and can he play can he apply his strengths to the context of the scheme? So like Fletcher Cox, for example, who's a pretty good penetrator off the ball. He's a great player. But what he does really well is shed blockers as the play progresses. He's got a great second burst of power. So how does Fletcher Cox apply that, and what does it mean for the guys around him? That sort of thing. Versus another guy like a Vince Wilfork, who when he was playing, how well is he holding ground today? Is he anchoring? What's he doing? You've got to know who the players are and what they're being asked to do. But usually the guys are being asked to penetrate in some way, and that's often what separates players. You have to also figure out then how are they penetrating? Are they getting? Are they doing it mechanically? Are they doing it with explosive, athletic movement? There's different techniques involved, and that's a whole different discussion. And a person could make a living watching only defensive line play and analyzing that for someone who needs that analysis. You could watch that all season long and be just as busy as everyone else.
But let's jump to the next question. This is why not 1-1-1-1. Why do so many fans hate the Patriots? How does the hatred for the Patriots compare to hatred of prior dynasties like the Jordan Bulls or the Cowboys of the 1990s? I would probably start with the uniforms. People hate those. other than that, I mean,
We're no more qualified to answer this than anybody else. People have their opinions. The bottom line is the Patriots win a lot, and some people in the NFL and a lot of people outside the NFL think they cheat. I don't think they cheat. I've never thought that. But there are reputable people in pro football who absolutely believe it, and they'll tell you why they believe it off the record. And so that's where a lot of the hatred comes from. I don't think any of it's true, but I don't know that for sure. I mean, anything else, though, we're just saying what anybody in a bar could say here, aren't we, Gary?
Yeah. That's why I've been drinking all morning to answer this question here. No, I mean, they've been around forever, too. No one really, and correct me if I'm wrong, Andy, but no one really hated the Jordan Bulls at any point.
No,
I loved Jordan. I loved that team when I was growing up, but no one really hated
that. I don't remember that either. Yeah, I don't either. I know my dad one time got mad at Jordan, the game where he had the flu in Utah. Around late in the third quarter, my dad finally got upset because Jordan was just better than everyone else and it wasn't fair and this isn't fun. And that's like what happens with – I mean, that's what a dad would do if he's watching his kid play AAU basketball against a bigger kid. You know, you finally get mad at the bigger kid. But that doesn't count. That's nothing. And my dad doesn't remember he ever felt that way. So – I don't know why people have the emotions that they have.
People did hate the Cowboys, though, in the 90s. I'll say that.
Well, remember, in the Cowboys in the 90s, remember, and people aren't saying this right now, that team had a lot of off-field issues as well, and that was before off-field issues garnered the kind of attention that they do. The Cowboys, from what I can recall, and I think it's more about just the way society interpreted what we expect of our athletes off the field, they were really that first organization where you said, well, they don't care about character. They have off-the-field troublemakers. People started to care about that around the 90s, and Dallas was the team that was always screwing up. Now they're doing it again. There's been one common factor amongst those teams, one common guy. I think people know who that would be, and he probably doesn't care a whole lot about that. But that, and I don't mind that he doesn't care. It's his prerogative as well. But that rubs a lot of people the wrong way.
It does. It does. And now we have an NFL that has decided they were going to put in a system to call attention to those things all the time.
Oh, and that's because it was rubbing people the wrong way, and it's bad. It's bad public relations, and the NFL. People say, "Oh, the NFL public relations, they're just doing this for the public." Of course they are. That's their business. They have to make the public happy. The public's their customers. So
they shot themselves on the foot. It backfired. It went the other way. They end up just they're just calling more attention to this stuff as opposed to saying we're being tough on this, because there's no such thing as going out there and being like, oh, this guy did this horrible felony, and we're going to be tough by suspending him from work for a number of games. There's no right answer to that. Any felony would be like a lifetime ban in terms of games, so it's stupid.
It changed when they got it wrong by under-punishing guys. It's probably the Ray Rice as the example. Because remember, also 10 years ago, when Roger Goodell came aboard, he was applauded as the new strong-arm sheriff in town. And Adam Jones, who was getting arrested every other day, Goodell finally said, forget this, you're suspended, or the bottom end of it. We're not going to do this. We're not going to have all these appeals. I'm sure they had it, but you know, they weren't going to make a big deal about anything. We're not going to try to find a formula to make it. You're suspended. You're done. You're done until we say you can play again. And he did that to Chris Henry as well, the Bengals receiver, who was always mm-hmm. getting in trouble. And people said, yes, good, finally, because these guys were making all the NFL look bad. Well, now the NFL, they've had a few under punishments, and then it's gotten complex. And the complexity, you're right, that drags everything out and makes us focus on it. And now we're comparing, well, Ezekiel Elliott, what did he do compared to what Ray Rice did? That's not the way you want your running backs being compared by fans if you're the NFL. Yeah. So everything was better off from a public relations standpoint when Goodell just strong-armed people and got away with it. He didn't. Nobody got mad at his power until the power was under-applied.
All right, next question is devolution. Given the supply of offensive players, especially from college, are almost exclusively from some form of spread-based system, and the short time coaches are given to turn around a team, when will a new coach or franchise looking for a quick turnaround just implement that player's spread offense from college, presumably? I'm throwing that last part in. Could this be one potential way to mitigate injury is by using a committee, QB by committee, you know, if you're concerned about your quarterback taking too many hits and maybe a run-heavy type of approach. So, yeah, two questions there. Should a team just basically adopt, you know, one-to-one a college-style spread read option offense? And should NFL teams also consider using a quarterback by committee if they do that and just sort of run through a couple quarterbacks over the course of the season?
No on the quarterback. No, we just said there's only about 22 really qualified ones. There's already a shortage at the position, so you wouldn't be able to do that effectively. And we talked about the college spread thing, I think, one or two shows ago. You can't do college stuff in the NFL because the hash marks are different, so the field spacing is different, and then the speed of the defense is also different. So you have to – teams do adapt and bring in college things. They adapt to all the changes in college all the time, but there's a limit on it because it's a different game. It's a different field. It's different setup. It's different rules in some cases. So you're not going to just take an entire college offense and make it work in the NFL.
But you see, and Albert Breer just wrote a piece about this. You'll see it on the MMQB soon. Lots of stuff from college being borrowed, put in the NFL. So, happens to an extent.
Sure.
Next question.
Oh, yeah.
This is CB Young, 88. Do coaches prefer more naturally talented QBs with inconsistent fundamentals, a la Cam Newton, or more fundamentally sound quarterbacks with limited ceilings, a la Andy Dalton? And I guess that's a case-by-case basis, and it also depends at what stage are these quarterbacks in. But I don't know. What's your answer to that, Andy?
It depends on how talented. It's all a matter of degree. How talented are you? Does it overcome it? Do the pros outweigh the cons? I mean, it's some of that's a little bit common sense, to be frank, Gary.
All right, next question is Adam Worrell. Do you like the current overtime rules? No, I do not. Would you support eliminating overtime during the season, but during the playoffs require a team to have the lead and possession to end the game? I agree 100% with both things Adam just said right there. What do you think, Andy?
I'm fine with the setup. I know it's imperfect, but I am overall... I'm fine with how it is.
Would you object to those changes, which should be made?
You have to have the lead and possession in order to win. In the playoffs, yeah, I could go with that. Regular season, I think you do need to keep the game. You have to say, hey, five quarters is enough, boys. And if they're still tied after five quarters, then the best outcome is a tie, because you all the point of winning and losing is to simply depict who played better, who outplayed who, and if they're still tied after five quarters, then I think that's the answer, is it was too close to call, and that's the best thing for the standings, rather than just finding a way to give somebody a win and somebody a loss that might not reflect accurately how the game went compared to a tie. So I have no problem with the way it's set up now. I understand how people might not like that that you can't get a possession if you give up a touchdown on the first possession of overtime. But it's, and in the playoffs, maybe you do want to give everybody equal possessions like that, or this guy, the way he worded it was excellent. Have to have possession and a lead for the game to end. I could go with that on the playoffs.
I think get rid of the regular season OT. Don't need it. Game is tied after four quarters. It's tied.
That would not go well for the NFL. People would hate that after a while. That would not go well at all.
I'll look at the numbers. I'll figure out how many ties we have in a year. But those overtime sessions are absurd.
Well, what's
guys
absurd about? There's
just,
no commercial
just destroyed
breaks,
and then they can't play next week.
Then it's when are you asking them to play? This issue didn't come to the forefront until Thursday Night Football came along. That's what causes a lot of the problems.
Yeah, that's a whole other thing. But next question here. This is R Verma 3. Andy, this is right up your alley. Who would you rather have going into year two, Dak Prescott or Carson Wentz?
I would rather have Carson Wentz. And I as I've said, I think he's the guy I want if I'm building a team for the next 10 years. I think he can run any type of system. He is excellent in the pocket. He can extend plays from within the pocket, which is a huge trait that not a lot of guys have. He's also people don't realize he's mobile. They don't think about that with him. But he can run around and he can scramble, and if they want, they could do design runs with him on a limited basis, and that's all it would take to force the defense to account for him in the running game, and that would really help them out a lot. So Wentz can do all the things that Prescott can do. He's not quite as athletic as a runner, but he's still in the conversation. And then he's much more as a pocket passer and a play extender at this point. Prescott might be that as well, but Wentz has that country strength and the ability to throw the ball under severe duress. And we don't know yet if Prescott has that or not. We haven't seen enough yet.
All right. Next question. This is actually just a comment that I'll share. This is from ECSWLA. Well, I don't know what it is. But we've talked about this, Andy. He or she simply asked, can we identify players with position team more often? Because we've talked about this off the show, that's my fault. I got to do a better job with that.
Yeah, I do too. I know, and what he or she means by this is, if instead of saying Jermaine Effetti, we need to be saying Seahawks offensive line or guard/tackle Jermaine Effetti. We both need to work on that. We've been told that too. We ought to be better than that at this point, Gary.
It's fallen on deaf ears, I guess. Next question. This is from Elam's widow. Andy Benoit made a comment about defensive linemen being better athletes than offensive linemen and mentioned as evidence the fact that there is an 80-pound weight difference. They're lighter, in short. With all the fast, complex offensive schemes, why isn't there a trend towards smaller, more agile, more athletic offensive linemen? Why not have some, 250-pound offensive tackles to counter your speedy edge rushers, Andy?
Because if you have a guy like that, you're going to want him to be an attacker, a playmaker, and that means you're going to want to make him a defensive lineman. Offensive linemen cannot make plays. They can only prevent plays, at least as pass protectors go. In the running game, I guess offensive linemen can be creators. They can mow over people, but that's more limited still. It's the bottom line, and if a team were to go with 250-pound linemen, then the defense they'd put in the 280-pound defensive lineman and overpower them. It's a cat and mouse game. And there's always going to be a bigger lineman out there. Those guys tend to play offense because the bigger guys are not as athletic of a creator as the smaller guys usually.
Well, also, and the problem is if your defensive lineman can simply overpower your offensive lineman who is now smaller, that's a much straighter line to the point where the defensive lineman wants to get to, just straightforward through the blocker. Correct. At least you have to go around a 300-pound guy.
Correct. Yep.
This next question is from Badiak, who says he's from Virginia, but also claims he has never heard of me, which I do not believe. So you're lying there. His question is, when Pete Carroll's defense was the best in the NFL a few years ago, it was also among the most unique. Now that Gus Bradley, Dan Quinn, Ken Norton Jr., and Robert Saleh are running defenses similar to it across the NFL, how do those defenses compare to each other? I don't know. I'd say this, Andy. What differences do you see in the systems that Bradley, Quinn, Norton, Saleh run compared to what the Seahawks run?
They're all very similar. They're simple, and when you have simple, it becomes a function of your talent. The more talented you are, the simpler you can play. So Jacksonville diversified their scheme a little bit last year because their pass rush wasn't getting home over the course of the season, and so they had to generate pressure. So they became a little bit more of a blitzing team rather than just a straight 3-4 cover 3, or excuse me, 4-3 cover 3 team like Seattle would be. Man coverage is also preferable to zone coverage at times. And some of these teams that have good corners, Atlanta's the best example. They played more man coverage as the season progressed. But it all starts with the same idea that it's a simple scheme, and the more talented you are, the simpler your scheme can be, and the simpler your scheme, the faster your guys can play. And you start with that and then work off of that.
All right. Next question. This is Ianahu. Go back to the Super Bowl here. Why did the Falcons kick away in overtime, giving up 25% of the field right away with no effort on New England's part? Obvious special teams difference between the two teams. We talked about this a little bit. I actually, if I remember correctly, you picked Steven Gutkowski as your special teams player of the week on Super Bowl 51 because of the fact that they were so good. Gutkowski, while he missed the extra point, was so good at kickoffs. Basically pinning the Falcons back, and field position obviously played a big role. And I, my guess is that's just not in the, that was not in the Falcons, I don't know, their tool set for that game.
And maybe, yeah, well, or they could have felt at that point in the game that their special teams were tired or were safer. They obviously, they felt it was safer to just take the touchback rather than try to pin New England deep with the kickoff. That's the likely thing. It's also possible that the kicker overkicked and missed on it. That happens too. That happens more than we probably would guess. I don't know what went into that. Only they could tell you.
Yeah. But that's a good observation. And Andy made that observation back in February. Next question here. This is Conniving Sea Otter. We saw last season the Jaguars underperform with a talented defense at every level. On the flip side, who are some defenses that rely on scheme and game plan because they are lacking in overall talent on that side of the ball? So who's getting the most out of their talent on defense, Andy?
Well, who gets the most out of their talent, or who are we asking the part where who lacks talent so they have to scheme it, or are those the same
things in your mind? Who has lacking talent but is a good defense despite of that lacking talent? Is that a better way of phrasing it?
I guess, yeah. And while I'm thinking of it, the most glaring example of a team that had to scheme around talent last year was San Francisco. They changed their fronts a lot. They diversified their coverage concepts. They had personnel rotating in and out. They were doing anything and everything to try to get the right mix on the field because they just weren't great. And linebacker is a big issue for them. And they wound up being, by a pretty good margin, the worst-ranked defense in the NFL. So it's not easy to just scheme your way around it because schemes still rely on somebody doing their job. And
yeah,
I'm trying to think, who does the best job of that? We've
talked about the Patriots have non-traditional. I mean, they don't have a great edge rusher. There aren't a lot of teams that have great defense that don't have great edge rushers.
Yeah, and what they do really well in New England is put players in their specific strengths. As like Kyle Van Noy is a coverage linebacker for him, not a stack linebacker against the run. And they use their fronts to put guys in the right positions for that as well. So, I mean, that's one example. I hate to just say it's New England because that seems like an obvious one.
That is pretty cheesy.
And what's unique about them is they don't run a lot. When I hear this question, I tend to think, well, who's doing a lot of stuff with their scheme aggressively? Who's doing a lot of different blitzes, a lot of coverages? That's not New England. They don't do a lot of scheme-wide alterations, but they do a lot of nice little wrinkles within the scheme that really help their players out. So that's one example. Another one that comes to mind, New Orleans with Dennis Allen. He did a good job, or he does a lot, with his defensive fronts. He goes to 3-4 type of fronts, or uses a nose tackle in a lot of things. And then he changes things up and moves his safeties around and really disguises. He does a lot of stuff. Now, it didn't work for him in Oakland. I thought he did too much, and that's part of what got that regime overhauled there. But that's the way he plays, and there are times where you can overachieve by playing that kind of football. If your corners have a good day, then the rest of your guys can be used aggressively on blitzes or coverage disguises inside, and now you're a swarming defense rather than a reactionary one. Dennis Allen has done a pretty good job with that at times, and there's no coincidence they went out and drafted Marshawn Lattimore this year to be a star corner for him, because that's how Allen wants to play. He wants to line up outside, get one-on-one coverage there, and then he's going to be very complex inside. And those guys, it works well for him when it does work. Can also get you burned, though, too. I mean, those teams like that, Greg Williams has always been this way. Yeah. They might hold you to 200 yards 1 week, and they might give up 500 the next week.
Yeah. Next question. This is from Jesper BW. In an alternate universe / timeline, Aaron Rodgers replaces all of Tom Brady's seasons under Bill Belichick, and vice versa, Tom Brady plays under Mike McCarthy. Who comes out ahead compared to what the other was able to deliver? So, yeah, let's go back 10 years. Well, more than 10 years for Brady. But Brady joins McCarthy's Packers and Rodgers joins Belichick's Patriots. Who's better there?
Rodgers is the difficult part of this discussion because he is so unconventional and he's very different than Brady. Rodgers does not play on time. He does not always play within the structure of an offense. Sometimes he does, and when he does, he's tremendous. But a lot of times he doesn't. He's also tremendous then. But you have to be willing to live with Rodgers' freestyling approach a little bit. And so I don't know if, like, the way I'm interpreting the question, could Rodgers run the Patriots offense? What would that look like? And then what would it look like if Brady ran the Packers offense? I'll tell you this, both offenses would look worse. And that's not any surprise. These offenses have been tailored to these guys, especially superstar quarterbacks like that. But Brady would not get as much help with their man-to-man beaters. They don't have that stuff in Green Bay as much. He would not be helped by the man zone indicators quite as often. That's a little bit more of we're going to out-execute you type of an offense. Brady, he'll out-execute you, but not until he first outsmarts you. That's how he out-executes you. He gets you in a predictable look, or he figures you out, and then he beats you. Rodgers will beat you after the snap more. So the question then is, would Rodgers run New England's offense with any kind of discipline? Probably not. Not the way Brady does. Both guys would be worse, but both teams would still be contenders. No question about that.
Yeah. Next question is coming from John from the UK. With Gronk redefining what teams look for in a tight end and the trend for multi-skilled guys such as hybrid defensive backs, etc., what, in your opinion, will be the next player/position trend as far as sort of redefining what the NFL looks for in these guys? I feel like this is already a thing, so I don't know if it's upcoming, but you see a guy like Christian McCaffrey, who is, I mean, he's essentially a slot receiver. But, you know, he comes from a college system where he ran a lot of power, ran a lot between the tackles, so he is a running back as well. He can do either of those things at a high level.
Yeah. That's where my mind went, was those hybrid running backs, the Theo Riddicks of the world, the guys that can play running back and slot receiver. I could see that becoming more regular. And then the inverse to that, it also answers the Gronkowski side of things a little bit. And I don't think Gronk's the best example. I think Jordan Reed, Travis Kelce, more receiving-oriented tight ends kind of show how that position's evolving. But I get the question. The defensive side, though, would be linebackers becoming more athletic and more versatile. We've already seen it with safeties, but at some point it's going to have to happen with linebackers because I believe the running back is going to be the position that evolves now that the tight end's already evolved on offense.
Yep. Next question. This is Big JBTX. What do you think of this trade? Oh, a hypothetical trade. Drew Brees to Houston for J.J. Watt, evening out with some draft choices if need be. I mean, realistically, it wouldn't happen. I mean, this is NBA-type talk at this point. But I don't know. Would you do that? Either side? Should either side want to do that in a vacuum here? I mean, you know, the Texans, you basically add Drew Brees to a team that was that threatened the Patriots in Foxborough last January, and if you're the Saints, you sort of get a slightly younger guy, and you certainly get a guy who can redefine your defense, assuming he's healthy.
I would not trade J.J. Watt if I have J.J. Watt, so I guess I would not do the trade. Drew Brees is great because of how he has mastered Sean Payton's offense and what that means. And Sean Payton's offense and Bill O'Brien's offense are two different things. So both players are more valuable to their current team than they would be to the other team. Brees is more valuable to as a Saint than he would be as a Texan, even though the Texans could really use a guy like Brees. And Watt, I believe, is more valuable as a Texan than he would be as a Saint. So I don't know. These hypotheticals, too, that's tough.
Next question. This is Peter 987-65423. Peter,
this is phone number.
I'm going to dial it after this. This is the worst question we've gotten, Peter. I'm sorry. my question is Gary's background. How did he start podcasting and editing? What goes into the day to day for a Sports Illustrated editor? I mean, I'm not even interested in my own day to day life for the most part. As far as how I got into podcasting, it's kind of like. Hey, did you ever see Stripes, the movie Stripes, the old Bill Murray movie?
I haven't, no.
Oh. There's a scene. Sorry. They're all sort of getting to know each other in the barracks, and John Candy says something along the lines of, you know, I don't know if you guys know this about me, but I have a little bit of a weight problem. So I would say my podcasting career, I don't know if you know this about me, but I'm not really professional at this. I just Robert Mays left, and we needed someone to podcast with Andy, and I like Andy, and I said I'd like to try it and do it, and I've gotten to a point where I'm like, I went from like an F plus to a D minus, I think, and I think that's good enough for this show with Andy sort of canceling it out. So that's how I did this. As far as my day to day as an editor, it's for instance, today I did a 3,000-word magazine piece for Albert Breer that took most of last night and probably about three more hours this morning, and edited one of Andy's things, and I'll edit a Jenny Brentis piece when we get done with the podcast here. I also write my column during the regular season on Saturday nights, and I'm starting a video show, which, depending on how it goes, I'm taping it and producing it myself, and it might never see the light of day. I'm going to show it to some people, and if they hate it, I will never let anyone see it. But that's my life, Peter.
I'm going to answer this, too, because you'll never say it like this, but Gary Grambling at the MMQB is probably our most diverse talent on the staff. He can do a lot of things really well. And so he keeps falling into other jobs, and people have worried that he's going to get too many assignments because people want to see him do so many different things. You are very talented, Gary. And as an editor, by the way, he saved my Joe Don Looney article this year by rewriting my first two paragraphs, just redoing them for me. And that goes into it too. Sometimes these articles that you see on MMQB are very much group efforts, and Matt Gagne and Mark Moravec and Dom Bombasuto, and Gary Grambling have been great on my articles over the years. So it's much appreciated.
But I was going to say, your Joe Don Looney article, that was like 40 hours of your work, and then it was like 45 minutes of my work. So,
well, that's how much better you are than me, I guess.
Coming up at Sports Illustrated Kids, where we were just insanely short-staffed all the time. I had to do everything. I had to edit podcasts and edit video, and I had to learn all the stuff that I never knew when I came from the newspaper I worked at. And that's just kind of the way it goes. You're forced into things, and you have to get good at it. And if you don't get good at it, you you lose your job, and you go, I don't know, apply for a job at Panera. I'd love to work at Panera. I think that's my next career stop. This next question here, oh, Andy, you're gonna really dislike this one. This is from Duo Ellipses Op. Would there be any different results for the last few Super Bowls if the following rule were in place? The winner of any game post wild card can take one player from the defeated team. Then that player goes back to his original team after the season. So, for instance, the Steelers could have taken Eric Berry. The Patriots cannot, by the way, take Barry from the Steelers. They can take AJ Bouye from the Texans. The Falcons can take Bobby Wagner from the Seahawks. I guess it does play out differently. I don't know if it. I don't know. I guess the Patriots pick up Jadeveon Clowney and I don't know, Antonio Brown, and probably win the Super Bowl anyway.
Yeah, there you go. What's the next question?
I'm not sure how to answer that, Duo Op. I'm sorry. Next question. This is ACH101. Do you have any helpful hints on how to become a football coach doing your job, Andy, analyzing football stuff? I guess just general career tips, Andy, for someone interested in going into this field, because Andy could be almost a coach, probably. Maybe.
Well, I don't know about that, but
lot about coaching.
Maybe.
I'll say that.
Yeah, and it's easier to know about when you don't have to account for the wins and losses and actually come up with the stuff. You can just watch it and talk to the guys. I'm in a good position. I enjoy that. You have to be willing to work for free at some point, because everybody wants into these jobs. And if you want into the really good one, there's probably, seven media companies that kind of run the show, big powerhouses. Yeah. If you want into one of those, you have to have a resume, and in order to build the best looking resume, you have to probably work for free for somewhere. I did that for many years. I helped one of the Monday night announcers behind the scenes just a little bit, but just enough to have the relationship and get the experience. And I wrote for some reputable websites for free and got the name out there. So you have to be willing to do that. It's hard, because that's not a level playing field. I was in a position I could do it. I grew up with parents that were supportive like that, and they could pay my rent out of college for a few months if I needed it. Not everyone has that. It's a tough thing, but you gotta find a way to do it that way.
Yeah. Next question. This is Glasses O'Malley. That's a good username there. Do you think Trent Baalke will ever get another GM job? And what do you think of his drafting philosophy during the Niners' great run? He's taken a tough PR hit in sort of the post Jim Harbaugh era out there in San Francisco, and obviously lost his job eventually. But I don't know. I didn't mind the philosophy he redshirted a lot of guys. He took a lot of injured guys. He loaded up on draft picks, and he took a lot of guys who were basically first-round talents who had suffered injuries. And in some cases, it kind of worked out. In a lot of cases, it didn't. I don't know. I don't think that's necessarily a philosophy to flush down the toilet. But, yeah, things obviously didn't work out there in the long run.
Whether Baalke is in the NFL again or not will depend on his reputation. I'm sure he could get on a lot of staffs now in a lower level, number two, number three in a front office, but will he be a GM and run a front office again? That Harbaugh staff, they do not talk nicely about him behind the scenes. They did not like him. There are a lot of people that didn't respect Baalke, and you don't know how much of that's personal. Some of it obviously will be, but he has that working against him, because people in the NFL are going to be talking about him like that. And then the other thing I wonder is, do people in the NFL view those Niners teams? You know, Scott McLuhan put a lot of the pieces in place for that team that went to the Super Bowl in 2012. Those were guys McLuhan had drafted, and Baalke took over. McLuhan had his issues. He had to leave. Baalke took over and inherited some of the building blocks there. that could also work against him and his reputation for getting another GM job.
Yeah. Andy, we have reached the last question of the Mailbag Summer Series. Again, we're going to do the big blowout season preview, and we are going to fold some of the literally all the remaining questions will be folded into that. So, like, someone asked about Christian McCaffrey, someone asked about Ken Dorsey in Carolina. Those will be part of our Panthers discussion during the preview show. We have 10,000 Patriots questions. We will get to all of them on the preview show. So we have not neglected you. If your show was on the Mailbags and then wasn't on the season preview show, then write in and say what a complete dirtbag I am for missing your question, and then send your question, and we'll make it right somehow. But this will be the last question, Mailbag 5 here. This is from Elad, and I love this question, Andy. Let's see. In the 1990s, you had clear and distinct styles on offense and defense. The classic West Coast, Ernie Zampezi and Norv Turner, the Bills' K-gun, no huddle, run and shoot teams, the smash mouth teams. Nowadays, everybody is more hybrid and diverse and plays and styles, and the only difference is play calling and execution. It seems as if all the teams in the league are becoming almost identical in style and scheme. The game is certainly more equal than it was back then, but is this a positive development? And he's right. And I know what you'll say, Andy, if I could just cut you off before you start to speak, because I'm a jerk. There are differences, but they're more nuanced differences. For a casual or even like an avid fan, you don't pick up on some of these differences when you're watching the NFL like you did in the 90s when you saw very distinct styles in the league. So is it a bad thing for the league?
I wouldn't say it's a bad thing. I wasn't analyzing football in the 90s. I was a kid, so I didn't analyze it in the 90s. So I don't know how. I mean, to me that seems, I know it'd make my job easier if teams had very clear identities and didn't deviate from them at all. There's a reason that this has happened, though, the evolution. It's the computers. What happens in the 90s, teams had their playbooks and they had film and they had to hand write a lot of stuff. Now all of it's logged on a computer and you can sort by situation. You can sort by any variable you want. You can sort by personnel grouping, whatever. So teams have become a lot more specified because they're scouting the opponents in very specific ways. So it's not going away. It's only going to get more like this. And as evolution has come along, as the computers have come along, the evolution of the game has really accelerated because teams can scheme a lot more minutely now because they can organize and scout a lot more minutely.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll just say, I think a lot of people look at the college game and say, wouldn't it be cool if, you have Georgia Tech running their triple option and they're playing Clemson running their read option spread, and you just see these wildly different styles and systems at play. And I think a big part of the salary cap era is the fact that there are no one's at such a huge disadvantage from a talent standpoint. You know, if you are Vanderbilt and you're going to be playing Alabama, not to pick on Vanderbilt, but you're not going to have the same talent. So you have to come up with creative and original ways to beat a team that is superior to you in a large way. And you just don't get that in the NFL. And I don't know if you got it that much back in the day before, during the Plan B free agency type of stuff where teams were built a little bit differently and the 49ers stuck that, it seems like they were together forever. And more dynasties were built off of that and there was more of a hierarchy. But, yeah, I don't know. I don't know how I feel about it. I still like football, so I guess it's not that bad. But
I think you have to embrace this stuff. Ron Rivera made the comment that if they start showing video on the sidelines, that's going to punish good coaching because the good coaches are the ones that figure this out before the games. I didn't agree with that assessment. I've never had to be in Ron Rivera's position, so he has better experience than me. But I think anytime more information is better than less information. So if you can present more information, that creates more variables and more directions that things can go in. And I think as technology keeps evolving, football is going to evolve and it becomes more about versatility and nuance. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that's entertaining.
All right, Andy, that's a wrap. That's it for the Mailbag series. Thank you to Lou Pellegrino, as always, our producer, and our editor, Chris Basil, who is listening in live, I believe, for the first time. He's probably horrified at the amount of work he has to do on this show. but let me just say this, and Andy will back me up on this. These shows were a ton of fun to do. We were overwhelmed by the number of questions that came in, and quite frankly, we kind of wrote a check that our asses could not cash. But the questions were just phenomenal. We appreciate so much the enthusiasm and really the creativity of all the questions that came in. We appreciate you guys so much, and thank you so much for being a part of this. We really did love doing it. We were just completely overwhelmed by the pure volume of questions that we had to get through. And are still
getting through. We got through. We did five shows. It was better than talking about the preseason. And keep the questions coming, because we'll do this in the regular season, Sunday nights we record, so it's out very first thing Monday morning. We'll still fold these questions in when we can, because
we'll figure out a way to do it, yeah.
We like people making the show outline for us. It's otherwise we're relying on Jeff Irwin, and we all know that can go in any direction.
Had to get one more Jeff Irwin shot in there. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archived episodes of the MMQB Podcast with Albert Breer, the MMQB Podcast with Peter King, and this podcast, of course, the MMQB 10 Things Podcast, wherever you listen to your podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. Thank you so much. We will see you guys with the season preview extravaganza next week.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.